Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast from Grace Anglican Church of Grove City, Pennsylvania. Our goal in every sermon is to proclaim the bold truth of the Word of God, especially the undiluted grace of Jesus Christ. If you want to learn more about our church, check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go.
There is a chance that you are familiar with the gray and stirring poem by Cavafy entitled God Abandons Antony. It's one that I return to in life when I'm feeling low. It portrays the gruesome sacking of the city of Alexandria, the one-time home of unmatched learning, science, libraries, and cultural sophistication. Antony sat upon the throne of Alexandria in 48 BC until Julius Caesar ruthlessly attacked, ransacked, and torched the renowned metropolis. Beauty burned to ashes. It broke the heart of the world. And now Cavafy, in his poem, beckons Antony and his readers to stare as an army procession slaughters all of the glory in the city. He writes, "When suddenly, at midnight, you hear an invisible procession going by, do not fool yourself. Do not say this was only a dream, that your eyes deceived you. Instead, go firmly to the window and look and listen with great emotion to the exquisite music of that strange, terrible procession, and then say a final goodbye to her, to the Alexandria that you have forever lost." Cavafy beckons us to look at something we would rather not look at. He doesn't ask us to stare at cherubic newborn babies or stirring poetry or sunny college graduations or solemn mountain vistas. He wants us to stare at the most hellish tragedy that he could possibly fathom, the torching of earthly glory. The problem is that we don't do that very well. We don't want to look at the tragedy for understandable reasons, and Isaiah the prophet knew that. He knew that we don't like to look at agony because he, along with T.S. Eliot, knew that human beings cannot bear very much reality. It's just too hard. Now, Isaiah the prophet was a real person. Nobody contests that. He was a Jewish priest and prophet from the 8th century B.C. And Isaiah the prophet carried within himself a horror show. A horror show in his heart. He saw a prophecy of unparalleled agony that was coming down the pike in the future. He knew that the noble future of our agonized world depended upon one solitary sufferer. And he writes extensively about this sufferer in chapters 52 and 53 of his prophetic work. And you know the language, at least many of you do, the words that are used, that this man-to-be would be a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, a man without a criminal element who would somehow bear the criminal element that you have and that I have. Some innocent slain sufferer who would act as a sort of human lamb, a person that would take away iniquity, that would extract it from other people. Isaiah prophesies about this man, but fascinatingly, he also prophesies about the audience that sees this man, writes a lot about them, the onlookers who saw him die. Notice the unflattering language that Isaiah uses against those who surround this pained man. Notice also he uses the language of we. Isaiah wasn't alive at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, and yet he puts himself there. as if he's guilty of the same crimes. He writes, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man as of one from whom men hide their faces. We esteemed him not. We esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, our iniquities. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way." Lots of negative language about those who permitted this great assassination. But I'd like to focus upon those haunting words, those simple, jarring words. He was a man from whom men hid their faces. Isaiah thought that we could speak negatively. Human beings could speak negatively about the pained man. We considered him stricken by God and afflicted, accused him of all sorts of things. But the one thing we couldn't do, we could talk a good game. But when he came to us and was hung up on the tree, we couldn't look at him. We had to hide our faces. We had to shy away. We turned. We averted our eyes. We stared at the stony ground. We stared at the clouds. We stared at the eclipse. We stared at the Roman soldiers. We stared at the sad ladies, but not the man. He was a man from whom we hid our faces. And this is a way of describing the broad fallen condition of every last one of us. We stop looking. We develop within our eyes a smeary glaucoma that causes us to see and yet not see at all. We see what we want to see, and then we shy away from the very things that we need to see the most. Well, perhaps it's extra hard to look at Isaiah's prophesied Christ because Isaiah blames us for his great and public demise. Isaiah says this, "We did it." Again, Isaiah is foretelling a moment that was 800 years ahead of him, but Isaiah includes himself in the accusation. "We turned aside. This suffering servant hangs upon the rough-hewn wood of the cross because the worldwide conspiracy of sin and nihilistic addiction put him there. Therefore, according to Isaiah, we're all found guilty, red-handed and culpable." And that's pretty hard to look at. It isn't just that the cross shows a gruesome picture of Christ. The cross shows a gruesome picture of you and of me, at least according to the perspective of Isaiah. We just can't look at that, and so we hide our faces. An understandable impulse, because it is nearly impossible to really look at the most grievous things in life. It's why the news stopped showing the images and videos of the Twin Towers collapsing shortly after 9/11. We don't want to look at the chaos. It's why my therapist says that many of his clients waste fortunes on him because they lie in order to impress him with how their lives have dramatically improved under his therapy, because we don't want to look at our lives. It's why we sometimes offer crying people tissues so they stop crying, because we don't want to look at the tears. It's why we don't take our car into the mechanic when we hear a consistently weird sound, because we don't want to look at the bill. Magnify that times 1,000 and you get the situation with Jesus Christ, who shows too much blood and too much red-handedness. And so we opt out and we turn our face away. But today, Good Friday, is not a day made for distractions. It's about, for a moment, looking. Looking, really looking, staring at two things, really. The first more prominent than the second, but both are important. First, we have to look at the dying Christ. And then we have to look at the self that required a dying Christ. By the way, we know God is at work when we begin to look. That's the tell that he's at work. So first, we have to look at our tormented, destroyed sovereign. Even that dubious despot, Pontius Pilate, was right when he commanded us to look. After Pilate oversaw Jesus' secular trial and permitted Christ to be tortured, he then told Christ's accusers to, and I quote, "Behold the man." In other words, look. Is this enough for you? Look. We've tortured him half to death. Look at it. Look at what you demanded. Here are the results. Behold the man. Look at the so-called king of the Jews with his torn up skin and his beard pulled out and a crown of spikes on his head. Behold that man. Today, we have to take a politician's advice. We have to behold the man. Behold the victim of bad politics and bad religion. Behold the wise man abandoned by his pupils. Behold the noble man crushed by the cogs of injustice. Behold the healer publicly defiled. Behold the innocent lamb now punctured by rancid sin. Jesus is the spit and blood covered face of forsakenness. In other words, Pilate coordinates himself with Gaddafi and says, don't hide away from the midnight truth. Look at the midnight truth. Don't leap like an Olympian to Easter sunrises and shiny angels and flowered crosses, not yet. Instead, go firmly to the window and glimpse at our golden-eyed man and look what the world did to him and look what we did to him. Stare at the annihilated carpenter king writhing under a dark eclipse. And just like Moses' snake lifted high on a pole, the king is lifted high on a cross so that you would see it, see him. So we must look at him tonight. But also we have to look to the self that requires him. Look to the self that requires a dying, pained king. Now I have a friend who was very recently, a la 2 days ago, trying to intervene in a very messy divorce between his two neighborhood friends, a bitter husband and a bitter wife. He walked to their McMansion to see if he could help them simmer down in light of a familial civil war. Well, in the middle of the fight, the husband screamed obscenities at his wife and proceeded to get into his car and speed off. The wife, screaming at the departing husband in her yard, suffered an immediate heart attack at the age of 43 and collapsed on the ground. Anger can drive you to that place. Well, she asked my friend to put her in her own car and then drive her to the hospital, and of course he obliged. But he couldn't help but notice, after a few minutes in the car, that her car was a disaster. Now, he has his priorities straight, he's taking her to the hospital, but he's a little OCD, and her car was the opposite of that. Or the blight of an OPC, OCD, not OP, OPC. That's Orthodox Presbyterian Church. I love them, but they're not here tonight. They're great. Freudian slip. Okay, OCD disposition. I'm going to edit that out of the recording. So anyway, he's freaking out because around him is just bags of stuff. Next to him are two large bags of her own hair that she cut off so that she could give away to a charity at some point. Didn't look like that was going to happen anytime soon. There were also big bags of rocks, just random rocks. He found out later that the rocks she had collected from creek beds because hopefully she was going to paint them and turn them into crafts at some point. And then on the dashboard itself, with the speedometer showing but nothing else showing, there were post-it notes everywhere, little neon post-it notes with Bible verses from Proverbs all over them. His favorite was from Proverbs 4, given the loud, boisterous conversation that day, which read, "Keep your mouth free of perversity. Keep angry talk far from your lips." Can't win them all. Well, after she was transferred into the hospital and he had to drive her own car back to her house because she was staying there for several days, he discovered on the way that the post-it notes on the dashboard were deliberately placed in particular places so that they would cover up the 6 warning lights that showed that her car had more problems than a Ford Focus. Pious post-it notes covering up a real crisis. The car was a dark sacramental expression of her own inner life. Quite the metaphor for Good Friday and for our own lives and our own denial, because you are not fine. You aren't. And if you say that to someone, you are lying. No one in this room is fine, either because of capitulating to the darkness or because you're just sad and broken and lonely, and you wished that your life had turned out differently, but it didn't. We are not fine, and the lights are on the dashboard, but we so easily hide our vexations under little sweet pretenses. We hide our private lives that are cancerously addicted, our marriages that are loveless and dead, our family rhythms that promote the worst in every member, our children that are afraid of us and won't tell us anything anymore. We are not fine, no matter how much we repeat that stupid, tired mantra, as all the warning lights continue to flash under those cheap pieces of neon paper. And today gives you a sweet invitation. Maybe you could take a few of them off the dashboard. Maybe you could look a little. Remove a post-it note or two and look. It is high time to stare at the Christ and the self that needs the Christ. One way that we can do that tonight is through this optional exercise included in your bulletin. There's a confessional piece of paper and a pen. Don't look at it yet. I know your impulses. Don't look yet. Here's what I invite you to do. I invite you to write down the things that you're afraid to name out loud. No one will read them. Not me, not anyone else. And then, at the end of the service, as we sing, "Lord, remember me as you come into your kingdom," come up and place them on the bottom nail of the cross. You may remember those words, "Remember me as you come into your kingdom." They were uttered by an unbaptized thug who died next to Christ. He didn't know the doctrine of justification by grace. I don't know if he ever read the Bible. Doesn't sound like he has much theological interest. He didn't ask Jesus to go to heaven. He just didn't want to be totally forgotten by somebody that he regarded as important. So he asked if he could do him a solid and simply not forget him. And Jesus opens the door wide to take that guy straight into the place of eternal recovery. Well, that's you too, you know. You don't offer anything more. Your righteousness ain't righteous enough. Neither's mine. Who cares? That's not the point anyway. The point is to discover that you don't have enough, but someone else does. We do this little exercise as a way of showing that our malignancy inside, our very serious moral defects, can in fact be transferred to someone else, can be externalized and dealt with by the suffering King of Heaven. We will stay open as long as we need to tonight. This is simply one way of looking at ourselves and then looking to the crucified Christ who saves the self. So today beckons you to look. To go firmly to the window and look. The day bleeds into nightfall, but if we stare long enough, we will realize why we call this day of slaughter good. It is good. So very good. Because now, in light of him, you are forgiven unto the ending of the world. And you are not damned. You are not damned because he died. So look and see. Isn't that good?
Amen. Free at last, they took your life. They could not take your life.